The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payton for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Wall Street Journal, Religion News Service, and the Associated Press. First of all, from the Wall Street Journal on January 11, an article written by Francis X. Rocha, African bishops reject same-sex blessings despite Vatican's permission. Rome. The Catholic bishops of Africa collectively rejected one of Pope Francis' most controversial liberalizations, permission for priests to bless same-sex couples, saying that such blessings would cause confusion and would be in direct contradiction to the cultural ethos of African communities. The announcement is in effect a rebuke to Francis and underscores global divisions over his conciliatory approach to homosexuality, which has become a signature issue of his reign. Unions of persons of the same sex are contrary to the will of God and therefore cannot receive the blessing of the Church, wrote Cardinal Fridolin Ambongo Busungu of Kinshasa, Congo, president of the Symposium of Episcopal Conferences of Africa and Madagascar, and a member of the Pope's Advisory Council of Cardinals. Ambongo wrote that he was making a statement with the agreement of the Pope and the head of the Vatican's Doctrinal Office. Since the Doctrinal Office issued guidelines for the blessing of same-sex couples last month, reaction from church leaders around the world has varied widely, with welcoming statements from those in several Western European countries and expressions of concern and even protest elsewhere. Nowhere has the resistance been stronger than in Africa. The Vatican's declaration granting permission for the blessings has caused a shockwave. It has sown misconceptions in the minds of many, including members of the clergy, Ambongo wrote. The cardinals stated that individual bishops were free to decide policy on the matter within their own diocese, but that Africa's bishops' conferences generally prefer not to offer blessings to same-sex couples, citing biblical injunctions against homosexual acts. In addition to these biblical reasons, the cultural context in Africa, deeply rooted in the values of the natural law regarding marriage and family, further complicates the acceptance of unions of persons of the same sex, as they are seen as contradictory to cultural norm and intrinsically corrupt, Ambongo wrote. Ambongo noted that the Vatican guidelines stress the difference between same-sex unions and marriage, which the Church teaches can only be a union between a man and a woman. The Reverend James Martin, a U.S. priest who runs a ministry to LGBTQ persons, which has been commended by the Pope, commented, "The Vatican's declaration may be challenging, even threatening, in different cultural contexts. But I hope that all church leaders recognize the need to pastorally accompany same-sex couples, which is what the declaration calls for." Now an obituary, Dexter Scott King, 1961 to 2024, from the Associated Press. MLK Jr.'s younger son guarded family's intellectual property. January 23, Atlanta. Dexter Scott King, the younger son of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King, died on January 22 after battling prostate cancer. The King Center in Atlanta, which Dexter King served as chairman, said the 62-year-old son of the civil rights icon died at his home in Malibu, California. His wife, Leah Weber King, said in a statement that he died peacefully in his sleep. The third of the King's four children, Dexter King, was named for the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama, where his father first served as a pastor. He was just 7 years old when his father was assassinated in 1968. As an adult, Dexter King became an attorney and focused on shepherding his father's legacy and protecting the King's family intellectual property. In addition to serving as chairman of the King Center, he was also president of the King Estate. Coretta Scott King died in 2006, followed by the King's oldest son, Yolanda King, in 2007. Words cannot express the heartbreak I feel from losing another sibling, the Reverend Bernice A. King, Dexter's youngest sister, said in a statement. His older brother, Martin Luther King III, said, "The sudden shock is devastating. It is hard to have the right words at a moment like this. We ask for your prayers at this time for the entire King family." Now from the Religion News Service on January 11, an article written by Yonat Shimron entitled, "Sharon Brows on the Power of Saying Amen in a Broken World." Rabbi Sharon Brous is one of the most prominent rabbis in the U.S., known for injecting Jewish life with a bold, passionate, and justice-driven ethic. Whether it's the need to fight racism, build affordable housing, or oppose the Israeli government's lurch to the right. But as her new book, The Amen Effect, shows, she is also one of the most pastoral and caring. The book, which draws on ancient rabbinic wisdom and personal anecdotes, is an extended meditation on the importance of showing up, in good times and bad. The 50-year-old rabbi and co-founder of the non-denominational Iker Synagogue in Los Angeles suggests the antidote to the plague of loneliness and isolation is compassion and community. Brous calls leaders to lean into other people's pain and suffering and to view heartfelt encounter as a sacred act. She roots the book in an ancient Jewish ritual in which pilgrims circle the Jerusalem temple in the opposite direction as the ill, the bereft, and the bereaved, so the pilgrims could see and comfort them. It's a similar idea to the book's central theme, the Amen recited by the community at several points during the Kaddish, or mourner's prayer, in which the community affirms mourners in their time of grief. Though it draws on Jewish ritual and practice, the book is intended for a wide audience of both religious believers and people of no faith. Religion News Service spoke with Brous during a book tour stop that took her to New York City. The interview has been edited for length and clarity. Explain the idea of the Amen Effect and how it came to you. This emerged from my realization that this very old mourner's prayer that you say after a loved one dies is a powerful expression of solidarity and support from a community to a mourner who's in a moment of anguish. It's a way a community can create a container to hold and help reorient a person in their loss. Amen is a very old word. It goes back to the Hebrew Bible, and it's a word that also is used in other traditions, in Christianity and in Islam. And it occurred to me that the act of saying amen was an expression of affirmation of a person's experience. It's a relational word. We say amen to someone else's prayer. We almost never say amen to our own prayers. And so, built into the act is seeing, affirming, honoring another person's experience. It struck me that in this time of loneliness, social alienation, and disconnection, that amen is fundamentally a word of connection. The amen effect is what could happen in our hearts and in our society if we root ourselves in that kind of powerful expression of connection, an affinity for another person in our times of joy and also in our times of heartache. As you point out in the book, it's not the words or the message of the mourner's prayer that are as important as the act of saying it in community. That's the power of ritual, that in some ways it even transcends the words. Some people will resonate very much with the words of this ancient prayer written in Aramaic, but the choreography of the prayer, its dialogic nature, the fact that it's brought into community precisely at the moment that we feel the most upside down, that's what struck me as so powerful about this ritual. Your Grandma Millie is central to the book, especially her saying about showing up for a sima or celebration. Did she know something that maybe society has forgotten? I think she understood how fragile life was and that if we don't grab the moments of joy when we can, we are depriving ourselves of the fuel that we need to survive through the challenging and painful moments. And that's a wisdom that she shared a lot in her old age. It's a perspective that's obviously rooted in experiences of heartache and probably, I would imagine, missed moments that led her to recognize how critical it is that we do actually show up for one another when we can for those moments of joy. You mentioned that your synagogue drafted a strategy to counter the problems of isolation. Tell me a little about that strategy. Shortly after COVID started, we realized that there was this epidemic of loneliness and that once we were forced to physically separate from each other, many people lost whatever anchors they still had in the universe. I had one particularly distressing conversation with a young woman, and she expressed that coming to synagogue on Shabbat once a week was the only time she felt that people knew if she was dead or alive. With the restrictions on gathering, she grew fearful that she might die and no one would know. Once I heard this congregant express her fear, I held an emergency clergy meeting, and we decided that we had to devise a strategy where we were going to really try to be in touch with some regularity with literally every person in the community, to just let them know that they mattered to us and that we were not going to let them untether from this world. And I have to say it was extremely challenging. Our community is not small anymore, and we didn't get it right all the time. But we were very deliberate about making pastoral calls for no purpose other than just to say, it matters to me that you are alive in this world. Part of what we're trying to do is destigmatize loneliness and help people find each other when their instincts tell them to retreat from one another. People often retreat or flee from other people who are grieving or going through pain. Is it because they don't know what to say or it's just awkward? How do you deal with that? I think there are a lot of reasons why people pull away from presence in those moments. Other people's losses make us feel very vulnerable. It forces us to confront the possibility of our own loss, and that's very real. So we tend to avoid it. It makes us feel destabilized. If someone else loses a child, it forces us to confront the possibility that we too are vulnerable to potentially, God forbid, losing a child. So we pull away from those who've experienced loss in exactly the moment when those people need community the most. I'm a mourner now. My father died just before Rosh Hashanah. I know it can be overwhelming. And so I think that's another reason why people stay away. We don't want to impose. We make assumptions about how other people are grieving. But it could end up being very hurtful because it could lead to a real sense of abandonment, even for people who do have a lot of folks present for them. And so my rule, which is an extrapolation of my grandmother's rule, is to err on the side of presence. We should just show up, and show up in sensitive ways and in humble ways, and allow for the possibility that it's not the best time for the person to see us. You also write about the fact that, as a rabbi, you hear about people's pain all the time, and that can be exhausting. It can lead to compassion fatigue. How do you deal with that? People who are oriented toward caregiving are very resistant to set boundaries on that care, often at the expense of their own physical and emotional health. I believe it is critical for caregivers to understand that we all need to allow ourselves to be held by a community of care and concern that can see us and hold us in our struggle. As a rabbi, I've had to really fight to reinforce among caregivers in our community that it's okay to take a meal train when your kid is having surgery and you don't have time to make dinner. It's always the people who are the first to bring over the lasagna to someone who is hurting, who are the most resistant to having the community come and take care of them. But what I receive when I'm being cared for will only help me become a better caregiver when I return to work. The cover of the book is an image of a mended or restitched garment, which you explain in relation to the Jewish custom of kriya, or tearing a piece of clothing as an expression of grief. But most people aren't aware of the tradition of mending. The cover was designed by a dear friend, Lawrence Azarod, who had just lost his mother, and we had just walked through with him the rituals of grieving, including the tearing of a garment, which is essentially an externalizing of the tear of our hearts. It's an expression of our brokenness and a way of signaling to ourselves and others that we are not okay. So we wear that torn garment throughout the Shiva. But the ancient rabbis were very practical people, and they asked this question: what if a person doesn't have a lot of clothing? What are they supposed to do with a torn-up shirt or dress or jacket? And they decided that after the Shiva is over, one can stitch it very roughly with a different colored thread, so anybody who gets fairly close will be able to see that you're a person who's been all torn up, but you're on the mend. And then, after a full month has passed, you can stitch it up with much finer stitches. So only someone who gets really close to you can now see how torn apart you've been. The image resonated so profoundly for me. It feels impossible to imagine that we can ever stitch ourselves back together, but we can. And in some ways, it becomes even more beautiful than it was before, because now it holds the history of the struggle and of the process of healing. And that's my deepest prayer for us as individuals and for our society. Our next article was published by the Wall Street Journal on January 14, written by Jose de Cordoba. Nicaragua expels 19 imprisoned Catholic clerics to Vatican. Nicaragua released 19 clergymen from prison, including Bishop Rolando Alvarez, the country's most prominent political prisoner, and expelled them to the Vatican. The government of authoritarian President Daniel Ortega said that their release was a result of negotiations with the Vatican. The group also includes Bishop Isadora Mora, 15 priests, and 2 seminarians. This is a continuation of the repression against the Catholic Church, said Juan Sebastian Chamorro, a former presidential candidate who had been imprisoned and was expelled to the U.S. in February. It's the pattern. Any priest who talks in favor of democracy will be imprisoned and then exiled, he said. The Catholic Church has been targeted by the Ortega government since 2018, when a wave of nationwide protests rocked the country. The church took a leading role in trying to mediate a political solution to the crisis, which took the lives of more than 300 people, most of them killed by Nicaragua's security services. Angered by the church's role, Ortega accused it of being part of a plot to topple his government. The outspoken Alvarez, bishop of the city of Matagalpa, had been in prison for almost a year after receiving a 26-year sentence for treason. The prelate previously refused to go into exile with 222 other political prisoners who were stripped of their Nicaraguan citizenship and expelled to the U.S. Mora, the bishop of Osuna, was detained in December after he asked for prayers for Alvarez at a mass. In the 2 weeks after Mora's detention, the regime led by Ortega and his wife, Vice President Rosario Murillo, detained an additional 13 priests and 3 seminarians. Pope Francis mentioned the detentions in remarks to thousands of people gathered in St. Peter's Square on New Year's Day. A week later, he repeated his concerns. It's a crisis that has gone on for a long time with painful consequences for Nicaraguan society and the Catholic Church, in particular, the pontiff said. He repeated an offer to have a dialogue with the Nicaraguan government last year. Francis said that Nicaragua's government was a gross dictatorship and compared it to Hitler's Germany. Nicaragua's government said Sunday that the clergyman had been received by Vatican authorities as part of a process to promote understanding and better communication with the Holy See. The Vatican declined to comment. Brian A. Nicholas, U.S. Assistant Secretary for Western Hemisphere Affairs, welcomed their release. "Every individual deserves the right to worship at home and abroad," he wrote on X. In October, Ortega's government released and expelled 12 priests. Since 2018, more than 200 Catholic clergy have been forced into exile or refused reentry to Nicaragua, according to Martha Patricia Molina, a Nicaraguan academic now living in Miami who keeps a tally of government actions taken against the church. 12 religious orders, including Jesuits, to which the Pope belongs, and Mother Teresa's Missionaries of Charity have been kicked out of Nicaragua, Molina said. The Ortega government has also confiscated Catholic universities, such as the Jesuit-run Central American University, which the government said was a center for terrorism. The regime has banned Caritas, the Catholic Church's principal charitable arm, and most religious processions. Last year, the Vatican closed its embassy in Nicaragua. The detentions of the priests have drawn the attention of U.S. legislators. Last week, Representative Chris Smith, Republican of New Jersey, a senior member of the Foreign Affairs Committee, introduced a bill imposing economic sanctions on the Nicaraguan government because of its persecution of the Catholic Church and other human rights abuses. The Ortega Murillo regime is making a grave miscalculation if it believes it can continue its ongoing efforts to crush the church, he said on Sunday. And now, an excerpt from a review published by the Wall Street Journal on January 11, written by Charles Isherwood. Prayer for the French Republic Review, Antisemitism Past and Present. Prayer for the French Republic, being performed at the Manhattan Theater Club, at the Samuel J. Friedman Theater on West 47th Street in New York, and it closes on February 18. You might assume the play is set during World War II, but while Mr. Harmon's inexpressibly moving drama does include scenes from the 1940s, the family in question is grappling with the question of exile to Israel in the 21st century. The play, easily the finest of the Broadway season so far, was first produced 2 years ago by Manhattan Theater Club Off-Broadway. Even then, it was grimly topical. Now the play resounds with a chilling immediacy that leads it even greater and more unsettling power. It is an unhappy coincidence that the production, featuring largely the same flawless cast and the same expert director, David Cromer, returns as the world confronts a spike in anti-Semitism. But perhaps we can feel grateful that this beautifully realized staging so trenchantly addresses the here and now, however uncomfortable that here and now is. The Solomon family has long roots in France. They've built and sold pianos since 1855. But the contentious issue of where they belong flares when Daniel, played by Aria Shagasmi, the 26-year-old math teacher, son of psychiatry professor Marcel, played by Betsy Adam, and her husband, the doctor Charles Nail Nasser, stumbles home after an anti-Semitic attack, his nose bloodied. Marcel is of the Solomon piano dynasty. Marcel upbraids Daniel for not obeying her admonition to wear a baseball cap over his yarmulke. Religion is not something to advertise, she scolds, but the dark corollary is that it is something to be hidden in Paris in the year after the murder of four people at a kosher market. Mr. Harmon delves deeply into the vexing problems that the attack on Daniel, not the first, raises in the family, who have hitherto been firmly assimilated. Charles, played with grave thoughtfulness by Mr. Nasser, moved to France when his Jewish family in North Africa was forced to flee. Marcel and her brother, Patrick, were raised essentially without religion, although since her marriage, Marcel has embraced their heritage. As the family, which also includes Daniel's 28-year-old sister, the manic, depressive, but fiercely smart Elodie, reels from the attack on Daniel, they are also attempting, distractedly, to welcome a visitor, a distant cousin, Molly, from New York, a college student studying in France, with whom Daniel establishes a romantic rapport. It is when Charles has an unhappy revelation, "I can't live anymore here," he announces, adding that the family should move to Israel, that everyone must face the shadows of the past, the disturbing present, and the uncertain future, which they all interpret in different ways. Prayer for the French Republic certainly has prolix passages. Mr. Harmon's erudition is impressive, but at times you half expect annotations to be projected onto the set. The drama nearly grinds to a halt during a tête-à-tête between Elodie and Molly, as she delivers a harangue about the history of anti-Semitism in Europe, as compared with the U.S. When Molly says, "I'm only following about half of what you are saying," glazed-eyed audience members will sympathize. But despite professorial longueurs, the play surges forward on the power of Mr. Harmon's engrossing writing. Prayer for the French Republic addresses, with nuance, detail, and understated passion, the tensions and the connections between history and current events. While it tells of a particular family, it illuminates the troubles of all people caught up in the turbulent tides of history, as everyone is innocent is, even if some face graver dangers than others. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.